This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss a major effort to unionize Amazon workers in Alabama.
Bessemer, Alabama, 5,800 workers at a fulfillment center. If the union can win here, they could win across the South and then maybe spread to the North. This could be a transformative movement.
We'll also address the problem of making enemies out of those we disagree with and the problems for society as a whole.
Have you ever had a problem winning over a Trumper? Listen to Liz Joyner. She'll tell you what she does.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
There's an historic battle for union recognition going on now at the Amazon Fulfillment Center in Bessemer, Alabama, whose mostly black workers package and ship orders to customers across the South. The votes of 5,800 Amazon workers are being counted even as we broadcast. On March 29th, we will know the outcome on whether or not the first ever labor union representing Amazon employees with the retail, wholesale, and department store union will prevail against a vicious trillion-dollar company whose profits have almost doubled since the onset of the pandemic. Amazon owner Jeff Bezos is worth $184 billion and is one of the richest men in America. Amazon employs 1 million people, second only to Walmart, which employs over 2 million people. Because most of the workers at the Alabama Fulfillment Center are African American, the unionization battle is also a civil rights fight. They've gotten broad solidarity from everybody like celebrities Danny Glover, politicians Jamal Bowman and Bernie Sanders, and even the players' unions in Major League Baseball and the National Football League. Will a victory in Bessemer open the floodgates? Will other large company workforces be unionized? Will the South be unionized? Will it spread to the North? Historically, the South has been a dragon on progress in America, going all the way back to the time of slavery. Will this start to change? We speak today with Michael Goldfield. He's a former civil rights and labor activist and agitator, professor emeritus, and currently a research fellow at Wayne State University in Detroit. He's the author of numerous books and articles on race, labor, and the global economy, including The Decline of Organized Labor in America, The Color of Politics, Race and the Mainsprings of American Politics, and most recently, The Southern Key, Class, Race, and Radicalism in the 1930s and the 1940s. Michael Goldfield, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Why are workers in Bessemer, Alabama, of all places, trying to organize a union at an Amazon fulfillment center?
Bessemer is an interesting place, but this fulfillment center is almost brand new. It's a state-of-the-art facility, robots, computerized, and it's also highly regulated. Workers in this facility, every motion that they make and every number of pieces that they handle and everything they do is completely monitored and recorded. Although not as draconian, it's not so different than in the old days in the Welsh mines when the foreman was there with a shotgun making sure everybody worked as fast as they wanted them to. Secondly, in spite of these state-of-the-art facilities, there's very little safety for the workers, so the accident rates are very high at these facilities, and also cases of COVID are very high. That's something that has to do with the facility. Bessemer is also an interesting place that has a long history of militant unionism from the past, some of which extends up into the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s. So it was has a very activist background. Now, this is a long time ago, but what we saw in West Virginia when the school teachers struck, and there have been many militant school teachers strikes, particularly in Republican states, the school teachers had signs that hark back to the militancy of mine workers there, many of whom were quite possibly their grandparents. So that tradition seems to linger on from Bessemer, and we can talk a little bit about that later. But this is an interesting case, and it's also the first Amazon facility that's being brought to a unionization vote.
Mike Goldfield, why does this campaign seem so important to us?
So these Amazon facilities represent the something of the new emerging economy, and this is heightened and magnified by the pandemic. So there are probably 50 or 60 massive distribution facilities called logistics centers that have warehouses, trucking, and whatnot in the United States. And these are about 4 million workers. They're not going away. They're expanding rapidly. And as we know from the pandemic, these processing delivery systems are actually fundamental for the rest of us. As we said again, heightened by the pandemic, but they were important before it, and they've expanded greatly. And the companies that run these facilities, I mean, there are about a dozen big ones, but Amazon is by far the biggest. But Walmart has many of these facilities, so does FedEx, UPS, and a variety of other companies. So the central role that these facilities play in the economy gives these workers a fair amount of leverage. On the other hand, these companies, particularly Amazon and Walmart, are very anti-union, and they've done everything they can to crush unions and keep unions from organizing and bringing to elections. So while there have been some one-day strikes at Amazon facilities and organizing taking place, this is the first one where a union has actually won the right to have an election. So this seems critical. And the interesting thing is, if these workers are successful, none of which is foregone because there are lots of things stacked against them, but if this union is successful, it could serve as a lightning rod and a stimulating effect for Amazon workers and other logistic workers around the country. So, for example, if outside of Birmingham, Alabama, and Bessemer is basically a suburb, it's 12 miles from the center of Birmingham. If these workers are able to organize, you can imagine that in New York or Washington, D.C., or Southern California, workers say, well, boy, if they can do this in Alabama, why can't we do this here? So it has the possibility of having a stimulating effect for organizing in general. That's one of the reasons why so much attention has been paid, particularly in the press, to this campaign.
Michael, to what degree is this current campaign also a civil rights struggle?
Well, we know several things about these facilities. First of all, the frontline workers in the United States highlighted during the pandemic are disproportionately non-white and disproportionately female. The risks and exposure to the pandemic are higher for these workers. Companies like Amazon have completely disregarded the health and safety of their workers, which is one thing that has made people mad. So the other thing about Bessemer is a historically African-American city. Today, 72% of the residents of Bessemer are African-American, 22% white. Similar statistics in the city of Birmingham itself, which is the center of the metropolitan area. Bessemer also has an unusual history of labor and civil rights struggles. So in the 1930s and 1940s, in Bessemer itself, one of the most militant unions, it was a left-wing union, and civil rights-oriented unions was in Bessemer. This was from the mine, mill, and smelter workers. The union was defeated in 1949 in a fairly racist campaign, which I discuss in my recent book, The Southern Key, Class, Race, and Radicalism in the 1930s and 1940s. by the steel workers. But the workers who were connected with this union took over the NAACP in town, made it a very militant civil rights organization, mobilized mostly African Americans in other urban areas in Alabama, and took the lead in the civil rights struggle there throughout the 50s. So this area has both a heritage of militant labor organization, but also a civil rights struggle, which many of the people there are aware of. On the other hand, arrayed up against them is not only this trillion-dollar company with all its resources, but unlike in the 1960s when many of the black caucuses formed, particularly in the auto industry, where supervision was all white, the Bessemer facility has a large degree of black management, supervisors, and even some of the higher management who are actively engaged in the anti-union campaign. Also, the city itself lost not only its iron ore mining, but the steelmaking facilities in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and the area has been very, very impoverished. So the city government, which is all of the leaders, all of whom are African American, welcomed Amazon and have supported them because they brought 5,000 to 6,000 new jobs starting at $15 an hour, which is more than twice the minimum wage in Alabama. So this isn't a give me, even though the workforce is disproportionately African American and female because of the forces arrayed against it. So this is a civil rights struggle in general, just as much of the labor struggles during the pandemic have a civil rights component to them.
In your recent book, The Southern Key, Class, Race, and Radicalism in the 30s and the 40s, you argue that the South is central to everything that's happened in the U.S. today. Could you elaborate on that, please, Michael?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the South has always been key to understanding U.S. society, and this begins not with culture or social history, but with the economy, with racial slavery that began in the South. And, of course, this begins in colonial time, first with tobacco and sugar crops, later with cotton. This heritage of white supremacy continues into the present day. So this has left what I would consider a callous disregard for human dignity and the sanctity of human life, despite the strength of allegedly pious anti-abortion activists in the South. Over 80% of the almost 1,500 executions since the death penalty was reinstituted in 1976 have been in the South, with over half in three states alone. The South continues to this day to have the lowest level of unionization, the most anti-union laws, so-called right-to-work laws, most egregious violations of worker safety. And it's also not surprising there's a part of the country with the lowest level of support for publication and health care. And even Texas, a relatively affluent state, is the state with the largest percentage of people without health insurance even today. So transforming the South is really critical to transforming the country as a whole. What I try to document in my book is that not only has the South been a drag on the country, but it's also the place where some of the most valiant popular struggles have taken place, including what I discuss in great detail in the book, struggles in the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s, including in Alabama. So interestingly, by the early 1950s, Alabama was the most unionized state in the South. It had over 25% unionization. And to put that in perspective, there is no state in the United States which has that high level of unionization today. So this was a very pro-labor civil rights oriented, and the civil rights struggles in the 50s, 60s, and 70s that took place across the South were especially strong in Alabama, and Birmingham was obviously a focal point of the struggle of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. And also in some ways where the backlash was stronger, which included George Wallace. So transforming the South, which I argue involves unionization of a large part of the workforce, is really key to transforming the country as a whole. So it's not just picking up some extra votes of white liberals in the suburbs of southern cities, but actually unionizing the workforce and harnessing both the labor militancy and civil rights orientation to large-scale transformation. So the South is important historically and also still important for the country as a whole today.
What role, Michael, did the failure of the post-World War II campaign to organize the South, Operation Dixie, play?
Operation Dixie was an attempt by the industrial unions to organize the South and transform the country and the labor movement. It was the area of lowest wages, the largest amount of ununionized workers. And until I did the research on the book, I thought that it was a very important, significant campaign. But what I found out in doing the research, I was struck at how backward the campaign was. This was a period when the right wing of the CIO, who were basically liberals, were in charge. They were very much worried about PR. They hired inexperienced white male veterans, and they even tried to use them in the textile industry, an industry that was a significant percentage of female workers. It was not as that well funded. It was only had a fraction of the organizers and funding the two major campaigns in the 1930s had, that of steel and textile, both of which I talk about at length in my book. Choosing textiles was probably a bad focus, but the other thing is they thought they could go it alone and they didn't need allies, and that's a lesson that hasn't been learned by many major unions today. They refused alliances even from liberal church groups, Southern Conference for Human Rights, and even their own political action committee, no less more radical organizations, of which there were a lot at the time. They also thought that they could sweet talk the employers. They groveled before some of the most racist Southern politicians, often alienating pro-union constituencies in the South, particularly black workers at times. This was not a well-run campaign, and we've seen failures, for example, by the auto workers in key places in the South, most recently in Chattanooga, Tennessee, at Volkswagen, also last year, 2 years ago in Mississippi, where they refused to mobilize people broadly in the community and engage in more militant activities. So I think the lessons from Operation Dixie are lessons that the labor movement needs to be able to learn for the present time.
What is the role of Amazon and Walmart in the U.S. and global economy? And what difference would the unionization of their workplaces make?
Amazon and Walmart, I mean, they have different workforces, but both of them hire large numbers of female workers. They're at the forefront of replacing and transforming the retail industry, and both of them dominate it in different ways. Amazon dominates the mail order industry, and Walmart dominates the retail industry. Roughly speaking, and figures change, you know, from different surges, holidays, and ups and downs of the economy. But Amazon has approximately 1 million workers in the United States. Say 2/3 of them, at least as far as I can estimate, because they don't break it down carefully, are in these warehouse facilities, logistic facilities. Walmart has about 2 million workers, most of whom are in their couple thousand Walmart brick-and-mortar stores around the country. Both of these firms have been ferociously anti-union and in many important ways have a high disregard for their employees. Both of them have cheated. I mean, they've cut all sorts of corners. Amazon just recently lost a suit in which they have to repay $61 million to drivers who got tips that Amazon kept. Walmart, on the other hand, has had cleaning crews of illegal immigrants who they forced to work off the clock and didn't pay them for their wages, both of which are documented and have had lawsuits against them. So these are draconian companies making billions upon billions of dollars, and there are two companies whose labor forces and their profits have gone up immensely during the pandemic, but this has not led them to be more charitable toward their labor force. This is the forefront of the new economy, and also there are 12, 13 million industrial workers in the country, and it seems to me the reorganization of these workers could provide a huge push to transforming the country as a whole. Another industry that's prominent and we've heard a lot about during the pandemic is food production and food processing. A lot of this is in the South, so there are facilities that process chickens and pork and whatnot, including several big facilities not that far from Bessemer in Alabama. And it's some of these workers in these unionized facilities who are playing a big role in the organizing campaign. People from some chicken processing plants nearby have been outside speaking to workers as they go in and out of the factory gates to and from, not factory, but warehouse gates to and from work. The unionization of these workers could provide a big spur. So Walmart, I believe, is much more difficult to organize because they have smaller units, their stores, a couple thousand around the country. Amazon has, according to data that I have, in the 160, 170 of these logistics facilities around the country, and they're fairly large. They have several thousand. This one in Bessemer has, official figure says 5,700, although that seems to change day by day. The bigger facilities are easier to organize. Also more critical, you shut down a few Walmart stores and it doesn't affect the company's bottom line. You shut down some of these distribution facilities and Amazon gets messed up quite a bit. So I think the Amazon workers have a certain amount of leverage. And it's hard to compare them historically, but in Alabama, it was coal miners, steel workers, iron ore miners who had a great deal of leverage.
Michael Gofield, it's been great talking to you about this. What can listeners do who want to support these campaigns?
Well, I think that these campaigns get... union organizing campaigns get repressed more easily when there's no publicity around them. So I think people should do everything they can to publicize this. But there's actually organizing campaigns. What one of the big groups is Amazon. I think it's called Amazon United. They've had job actions, picket in places around the country. There was a one-day strike in Chicago. in the Long Island facility, workers were organizing. Amazon fired some of the key leaders. When these campaigns are taking place, people can support them. If they're nearby and you can do it safely, they can show up and add to picket lines. So Amazon workers get fired often for participating in these pickets. The rest of us can go there, assuming we don't get arrested for something, which doesn't seem to be happening at most of these. There's not much risk to us in terms of doing this. So there's lots of things that people can do. There's lots of online activity. We can all these days help publicize both what's going on in Bessemer, but also at these several dozen other facilities which are visibly engaged in actions. You know, I think we do what we can depending on where we are. And I'm here in Detroit. There's protests taking place at a big Whole Foods store here where they're saying that Amazon has not done things to adequately protect the safety of workers in the store.
Yeah, Amazon owns Whole Foods.
Right. Amazon owns Whole Foods. It's one of their few brick-and-mortar operations. But past couple of days, there have been a lot of people who supported the workers there who've showed up on their picket lines outside the store. And it's been publicized by people, you know, resending the flyers and everything around to their social media contacts.
Yeah, they also own the Washington Post. Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. I subscribe to it. I read it every day. I haven't seen any coverage of the Amazon strike. Michael Goldfield, we've come to the end of our allotted time here. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. One last question. How can our listeners follow your work?
I've been probably engaged in almost 100 events or interviews about my book in the past 6-8 months. On my Facebook page, many of these, not all of them, but many of the events get posted. I've written about a dozen different articles for a variety of publications, including Jacobin, Tempest, and whatnot. And I'll send you the discount coupon and the code, and you can perhaps give it to any of your listeners who are interested in getting the book.
We'll post it on our website. Michael Goldfield, The Southern Key, Class, Race, and Radicalism in the 1930s and 1940s, your most recent book, an excellent book. We urge people to pick up a copy. And Heidi and I thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It's wonderful to talk to you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Now, if you want higher wages, let me tell you what to do. You got to talk to the workers in the shop with you. You got to build you a union, got to make it strong. But if you all stick together, boys, it won't be long. You get shorter hours, better working conditions, vacations with pay, take your kid to the seashore. It ain't quite this simple, so I better explain just why you got to ride on the union train. Cause if you wait for the boss to raise your pay, we'll all be a-waiting till Judgment Day. We'll all be buried, gone to heaven. St. Peter'll be the straw boss then. Now you know you're underpaid, but the boss says you ain't. He speeds up the work till you're about to faint. You may be down and out, but you ain't beaten. You can pass out a leaflet and call a meeting. Talk it over. Speak your mind.
That was the Almanac Singers song. Pete Seeger was part of the group. The Almanac Singers were working with the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, in 1941 to spread the word about unions. And this song was developed to sing at union organization drives.
When asked about the state of politicians' discourse in the United States, the public renders a harsh judgment. Many Americans also say that their own personal conversations on political issues have become stressful incidents they'd rather avoid. That's according to a Pew Research poll. A majority say the tone and nature of debate between politicians has become less fact-based, less respectful, less substantive, and more negative over the past few years. And everyday conversations about politics or other sensitive issues like abortion or free speech are often tense. have say that talking about politics with people they disagree with politically is, quote, stressful and frustrating. When speaking with people they don't know well, more Americans say they'd be very comfortable talking about the weather and sports, but not politics. And it's those who are most comfortable with interpersonal conflict, including arguing with other people, who are most likely to talk about politics frequently and to be politically engaged. Why does this matter? The Founding Fathers knew that with any political issue came disagreement, so they created a system that runs on disagreement. The checks and balances between the branches of power within the Republic depend on division to protect freedom and liberty. The power of one branch is checked when another branch disagrees and seeks to enact its own ideas. So political disagreement, even bitter disagreement, is not new. What's new is the idea that someone who disagrees with you is your enemy. One organization is trying to change this. The Florida-based Village Square has the mission of reviving civic connections across divisions in American communities. Joining us today is Liz Joyner, its founder and CEO. Liz has a master's degree in social work and created the Village Square after her experience working in politics convinced her that the way we work out disagreements in today's public square is fundamentally flawed. Liz, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
What is the Village Square, and who does it serve?
The Village Square is a 15-year-old hometown-based model, so we're very focused on building bridges inside communities. We also describe ourselves as being a nervy bunch of liberals and conservatives who believe that dialogue and disagreement make for a good conversation, a good country, and a good time. And we're really very focused on kind of the concept of rebuilding what I think of as being kind of the quintessentially American town hall. It's kind of the way we've done business for forever, is, you know, gathering as neighbors in communities to talk about difference of opinion. And we serve, you know, the people in our community broadly across color, creed, and ideology. Really, we're always focused on trying to make sure that we bring in the broadest, most diverse group of humans into the room as possible.
Liz, how'd you come up with the idea?
So, I guess 16 years ago, Tallahassee, which is where our first location is based, had a very controversial debate on whether to build a coal plant. And, you know, it's funny looking back on it now. Really, I think we were experiencing what all communities were experiencing, and it's sort of the tip of the iceberg of what we all see so clearly now. But at the time, we just kind of looked at it and thought, wow, that discussion didn't really go all that well. It ended up going to a public referendum. And there was really no place for citizens to really talk about, you know, what their opinions are and to learn more, you know, about it from people who might not agree with them, et cetera. So, again, that's kind of the typical American town hall. And so we essentially set about building it. The model was really based on the fact that while we were kind of watching this public discussion that, you know, it kind of became about national issues, even though it really shouldn't have been. It ought to have been about how it was going to impact our community, but we kind of fell down in sort of the same kind of groupish tribal divisions that, you know, we see all the time now. And at the same time as that was happening, I was helping a local city commissioner run a reelection campaign, and that was my first and last real experience with politics. But, or at least on that side of it, and I got to see him discuss the issue with really close friends who completely disagreed ideologically and then also on whether we should buy into the coal plant or not. And those conversations were rich and informative and inspiring, where the others were just sort of silly and not edifying at all, and didn't move us forward. So I started talking with that, you know, group of community leaders about, you know, how do we turn this from a four-person discussion to 10 and to 20 and to 100. And that's when we got together and we started holding. Our first event was dinner at the square. I remember we had an audience of about 150 people that first time, and I thought to myself, what was I thinking? What's going to happen here? We're just going to blow up. But it didn't. And, you know, we have probably 30 events a year, and so we're hundreds and hundreds of events later now. We host events in bars. We host events in churches. We host events, an annual event in the middle of a downtown street that we block off that has essentially a table for 1,000 people. So we've spent a lot of time hanging out with each other in 15 years.
Liz, what is the overall social value of the concept agree to disagree?
You know, sometimes I think that we get confused about what the goal is. And for sure, in the public space and the public square and all the things we disagree about, sometimes we do have to sort of find a compromise and a resolution. But the truth is that sort of the very essential basis of American democracy is the idea that we talk, we engage with people that we disagree with, and we keep on talking. And that those disagreements aren't always, you know, we're not really always aiming to resolve them so much as is, you know, simply the process of understanding, understanding how someone who thinks about this, who has different life experiences than you do and a different ideology, sort of the model of steel sharpens steel, right? That you put ideas up against each other and they help clarify and edify. And really, that's the way that you solve problems. I mean, our very form of government is really based on the idea that if we're going to do this thing without having a king tell us what to do, that we have to be in it with each other, and that the minority keeps the majority, you know, in line and checks their excesses. And, I mean, really a lot of it in terms of the very nature of human beings and how we reason, that we need to have, you know, the Queen's loyal opposition back and forth to be able to do a good job. And we've kind of just lost the view of that completely. I really think that we've kind of forgotten our own brilliant idea that in my opinion, the framers were very kind of aware of human nature and aware of how we reason and aware of the pitfalls of not having each other to sort of disconfirm ideas that may be wrong. And so I really think that is just like the crux of all of this, which is that we need each other to be able to continue to steer democracy without, you know, it turning into autocracy and needing a king again.
So how did we get to the point where civic dialogue is so contentious or doesn't even exist? I mean, why do some view those who disagree as enemies?
Yeah, that's a great question. So to me, there's so many things. First is just the, you know, tumultuous changes that have happened in how we communicate with each other. When you think about that, it has just happened so quickly in ways that foundationally just shake everything completely up. You know, obviously, we've gone from having three channels on TV to having just, you know, basically choose your news. You can pick whatever sort of narrow-casted channel you want to fall into and hear what you want to hear, and your views never, you know, can never be challenged exactly. But also the internet is, there's so many glorious things about it, but one of the things that's most essential about it is it's a really great way to find people who agree with us, right? Who have some of the same philosophies and goals and dispositions, and there's great things that come of that, you know, from hanging out with people like cats all the way to really substantial and positive things that you can do together if you can find the people who are like you. And Robert Putnam calls that bonding social capital. He's the guy who sort of invented the term social capital, but also wrote the book Bowling Alone all those years ago that I think was definitely on to something important. But the problem is that with this sort of environment of just easy bonding social capital, we forget the other part of what we need to be doing, which is bridging social capital. So we're much less likely to seek out people who disagree with us digitally. Some of this is like expected adjustment period. You know, we've had to go through so many changes about how we hang out with each other that it's no wonder we're not really doing an incredible job of it right now. And so, you know, the next thing that we need to do is we need to understand the really deep complexities that we face, and then we need to be much more intentional about seeking out bridging social capital, disconfirmation for some of our biases. And I mean, some of this too kind of comes along with just human nature. It's just not that typical for us to kind of stretch outside of, you know, what we already believe. We look for confirmation, you know, of the things that we want to believe and we already believe, and that's just human. And then also somewhere along the way I found this really interesting concept. It's called Dunbar's number. Dunbar is a British anthropologist, and he defines Dunbar's number as a suggested cognitive limit to the number of people with whom you can maintain stable relationships. And that number is 150. And so, you know, he kind of suggests that once you're sort of beyond 150, it's a pretty complex thing for the average human to be able to process. And obviously, you know, where our networks are now way past that, and they're not geographically centered for us. So they're not people, you know, our relationships that we have online are not, you know, cross-cutting relationships where, you know, in hometowns and geographic locations, I, you know, can completely disagree with your politics, but our kids are in the same play group, so we hang out. And so we're the same in some ways and different in others, but digital relationships don't really, you know, kind of account for that. So I don't know. I mean, I think that's some of what's going on. And then I do also think that the narrow casting to us individually, I mean, the whole idea that you can run ads that just appear for the people who that's exactly their thing, kind of, and we're so used to that narrow casting that we don't spend a whole lot of time stretching.
Liz, that's sort of like being mandated to take courses outside your field of interest in college. The purpose is to diversify.
Mm-hmm. You're right. And it's really important, and it's an important part. I mean, it's not that we shouldn't do the things that interest us most, but it's part of making us a well-rounded human.
Liz, can you share your thoughts about so-called cancel culture?
Yeah, so obviously that is the rising tide of a topic these days, and actually we just had a program at Village Square about it. I have to say that I have a lot of empathy for sort of maybe what began to create this and the impetus behind the emotions behind what first started sort of giving us a rise of cancel culture. But I think my main feeling about it is that it's the exact opposite of what I've just described, right? if what we need to be doing is stretching out past ourselves, then you essentially punish people for that kind of behavior and for, you know, coming in and expressing a view that's a minority view in a particular setting. And then the results of it are that it essentially groups us up just with the people who already agree with us. And, you know, lots of things happen that are fairly inevitable when we're in a group of people who agree with us. And that is that the heterodoxy in a group, groups that have diverse opinion, they moderate. And over time, groups that don't have diverse opinion, get more extreme in the direction of the majority view. And to the point, there's all sorts of good social science on this, to the point of essentially denying factual reality. So if you want to reason well, the best thing you can do is have people in your group who, in fact, don't agree with it, because you can, again, check each other's biases. And so I maybe think of cancel culture a little bit differently than others, since I sort of stand in this breach between liberals and conservatives trying to get them to walk towards each other. So to me, the more that one side is canceling the other, the less interaction there'll be, the more extreme each group will grow, and then kind of rinse and repeat, right? It accelerates the dynamic that we're seeing that we know is just so destructive. And the other thing I'd say is that cancel culture is happening significantly on both sides of the aisle. And it is just a really interesting thing when you put it in motion and watch it, because, there's a lot of conversation about cancel culture on the left, and I do think that we've done some work on college campuses and have found, it's been a long time since I've been in college, so I was really quite shocked with how pervasive it is on campus and how so many people who are, moderate, even center left to moderate to conservative are kind of self-editing, in terms of what they believe. And so I'm really concerned with that dynamic. But, our former president was kind of counselor in chief. That's kind of how he used his Twitter presence, is that if you weren't, totally 1,000% with us, then you're against us and you're canceled. It's just not going to end well in a country that is diverse, because we've got to find a way to be able to see each other and hear each other, and people need to feel like they can be a part of this endeavor, across differences of opinion. So I think it's kind of the opposite of what we need to be doing as a society.
Michael and I had a wonderful colleague who passed away several years ago, civil rights attorney Arthur Kinoy. And he always used to say that, he taught at Rutgers Law School, that the answer to offensive speech is more speech. I think he'd be quite horrified at what's happening. As you say, on college campuses, it often seems recently that some of these practices, in my opinion, are happening among privileged communities that can sort of dictate these new norms.
I think that, it's interesting, and this is probably kind of a deep dive, but just to give your listeners just a little bit of a taste of it, we've had the privilege to work over the years with Dr. Jonathan Haidt, who wrote the book The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Religion and Politics. He's at NYU, and he started the organization Heterodox Academy. And John's moral foundations theory about the differences between the moral foundation that liberals and conservatives use to reason, I think, is a really important piece of a sort of part of the body of knowledge for us to help to sort of understand what's going on, because my politics are center left, and I would I really believe that we liberals see things through a care and fairness lens, and other sort of parts of moral reasoning that we tend to be less focused on. And I think that there's really something going on there. So I think there's a lot of really good intentions, but that are sort of stuck in a certain way of approaching the problem. Whereas if I were advising people who are concerned about social justice and equality, I would tell them that, in fact, they need to invite people in rather than cancel them out. That is the way that you move people's hearts, and you do it by sort of creating I don't know, you know, what conservatives think of as sort of little platoons, a sort of connectedness between people and groupishness with people who don't agree with you. And I would say just a very, very extreme example, but one that was incredibly constructive, was the black musician Daryl Davis set out to essentially befriend members of the Klan, and his ultimate goal was to get them out of the Klan, but he did it essentially by becoming their friend. And I mean, he was overt about it, and his rule was, you know, if you decide to leave the Klan, then when you leave, you give me your robe. He, in fact, has 200 former Klansmen robe. And, you know, obviously, this is not highly recommended, but it's an extreme example that makes you realize what the nature of just having contact with other people. It's transformational. So, again, to my mind, you know, they're doing the opposite. They're going to produce the opposite result of the one that they want to. And so, you know, it's really kind of tragic.
Liz, let's get to the nuts and bolts. How does the Village Square and its many programs sort of jumpstart civil discourse between people? Do you give them pointers?
We do somewhat. Very often it's because we're giving them an example at the front of the room. So in a very big audience that isn't as interactive, and we have lots of different kinds of events, one of the things we do is we very thoughtfully create a panel that we think has those kinds of cross-cutting relationships that can change people's hearts. And our goal is kind of, you know, does a conservative who comes to the program connect to what that liberal is saying enough that they think, wow, you know, I kind of like them. I may still disagree with them, but I kind of like them, and then vice versa. So some of it is sort of how you set up the room and the audience and the events. And at the beginning of each of our dinner programs, we give people a couple of sort of rules of the road, and one of them is that we ask them to not do any team clapping, because, again, that when you think about being in an event, all of a sudden those can get very groupish and angry when everybody sort of claps and when their side says something and then boos or a little bit or mumbles when the other side says something. So sometimes it's just sort of rules that we set for the whole group. And I guess the other thing that we do at big events is we have these civility bells, and they're just like little librarian bells, and we give them to a liberal and a conservative in the room, and we ask them to kind of especially monitor their side. You know, are they doing demonizing or vilifying or reading people's minds? And then we ask them to give a little nice ding, and that's kind of a carrot and stick approach a little bit. But then there are also events that we have that are more intimate, that include just table conversations between people, and we go through, you know, as sort of rules of the road, and people ask me for these all the time, and I'm happy to share them if anyone wants to email me, liz@villagesquare.us. And they start with, our goal isn't to agree, it's to disagree and keep talking. Assume good intentions by others. Use of the wrong words is allowed. Don't come to offend. Temporarily overlook offense. Disagreement and hate are not the same thing. Practice humility. You know, no matter how right you are and how wrong someone else is, you can always learn something from them. And they go on. There are a few more of them. So, you know, it's actually surprisingly less hard than one would think when people get in a room together and there's some sort of collegiality. You know, we always have food. Breaking bread is highly recommended. People actually do way better than you think. You know, humans are pretty reciprocal, and small kindnesses are usually returned, and so it's just kind of getting the virtuous cycle going faster than the current vicious cycle is going.
Kudos to you for delving into an area that many people avoid. How can listeners learn more about the Village Square?
So they can find us online at villagesquare.us, and then they also can check out our speaker pair series. We've got pairs of speakers and then also stories about pairs, kind of inspiring pairs now and in history of people who just disagree with each other but have done wonderful things together, and they can find that online at respectandrebellion.com.
Is that called Subversive Friendships?
The project is Respect and Rebellion, but then, yes, we describe what we call subversive friendships, people who are willing to stay friends with people they completely disagree with, and that's a thing now, as you know, again, cancel culture, right, is, you know, if you see somebody out having lunch with someone on the other side, what are you doing? Why do you have a friend who disagrees with you? But they turn out to be the most enriching friendships. I can speak from personal experience, and we really encourage people to, I don't know, just start with one person that you know disagrees with you and hang out with them a little, see what happens.
Well, Liz, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you today, and we wish you best of luck, and we'd like to stay in touch.
Thank you so much. I would love that as well.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.